You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 178 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. Well, I hope you got a chance to listen to our post-game pod after the Seahawks beat the Rams on Thursday Night Football on Thursday. Hopefully you were a satisfied customer like Bill Bardwell. I guess maybe wasn't satisfied that we turned on Ben B during the course of that podcast.
Now our mortal enemy. Ben B's the new Birion. The second B stands for Birion.
But that was a lot of fun. And then the rest of the weekend of football happened.
Oh, it wasn't that bad of a weekend of football.
In Seattle-related football, it was.
Because I'm 2-0 as a head coach.
Oh, okay. Congrats. Are we toasting to that?
I was more... Yeah, we can toast to that. I was more offensive coordinator this week. But many people in the crowds described me as Kyle Shanahan-like.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Kyle Shanahan going up 28-3 in the Super Bowl, or Kyle Shanahan after going up 28-3 in the Super Bowl?
We did blow a bit of a lead. There was a pick six that got taken away by the referee that they didn't inform us was taken away.
Oh, you want to know the score. That's usually yeah.
I would say that's one of the main ways that I consider myself Kyle Shanahan-like is my awareness of what the score is.
I feel like I would not be surprised if there were a game this season where Pete got the score wrong. Like, would that surprise
wow,
you?
Wow, no. That would surprise me. I mean, he was hit in the face with a football.
Yeah. It was
but
a rough
still,
day.
Like, you've gone too far, sir.
All right. You gotta cross the line sometimes to figure out where it is.
How many years do you get of no criticism after winning a Super Bowl?
5-year grace period. We're out of that, by the way. No one obeyed that. There was a lot of criticism.
including from us. Oh, man. If you beat the Rams on Thursday Night Football, you get at least a 1-week grace period.
Is that what Zach Whitman failed to obey?
Yeah, we get and some others on the internet. Well, oh, boy.
Including you, moments after your Zach Whitman pick. Quite a podcast.
We've got until Thursday. All positivity about the Seahawks until Thursday.
All right, well, we are toasting this.
The Huskies do not get such privilege.
From the Connecticut Valley Brewing Company, the Fueled by Gravity double New England style IPA. Oh, I've never heard of a double New England IPA.
Just to celebrate another great Patriot victory.
Yeah. Our beer is sponsored by Tavor. Tavor is an app that offers craft beers that aren't distributed nationwide for purchase. Local breweries make their beers available to Tavor, like Connecticut Valley Brewing Company in South Windsor, Connecticut, which I have not driven through. I've driven through Windsor Locks. That's where the Hartford Airport is.
Lovely.
But South Windsor appears to be eastern.
South Windsor was a bit dangerous, though.
You order the ones you like, and they'll be shipped together on a regular basis for a flat shipping cost. We're drinking beer sent to us by Tavor on the pod each week, and you can take advantage, too. If you sign up for an account with Tavor and enter the code PELTONCAST in the promos section, you'll get $10 credit after spending your first $25 with Tavor. So let's crack these open. And a toast to you going 2-0.
Oh, yeah.
How was Baby Fantasy Genius?
He was great.
We haven't talked about this at all.
He was great. Star quarterback. I mean, he threw what is considered in a first, second grade football league, he threw a bomb for a touchdown.
Nice.
It was a play where we'd drawn it up. There's a kid who's significantly younger than anybody else on the team.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's mostly snapping the ball, right? He doesn't get involved in the offense too much. So we had a play where he's supposed to snap it and then leak out as the receiver.
You're eligible?
The center is eligible. Everybody on defense completely forgets about him, right?
Absolutely.
So Luca, the quarterback, he's standing there wide open. Me as the offensive coordinator, I'm screaming. I'm like, throw it to him. And then instead he throws it like 10 yards downfield, which is a massive pass for a second grade team.
Yes.
10 yards downfield. That ends up being a touchdown. I feel like a lot of my coaching is me telling the players to do something and then them scoring a touchdown on that play.
By doing something else.
Yes,
entirely.
By doing something completely different.
Yeah, that's good coaching.
But also, you know, I'm trying to get everybody involved here.
You got to do that. All right, well, besides your coaching, we are also toasting this week to Natasha Howard, Seattle Storm forward, who was named to the All-WNBA first team on Sunday when that was announced. So another tremendous honor for Howard, who was the Defensive Player of the Year this year, coming off winning Most Improved Player in 2018.
A monster season for Natasha Howard.
Absolutely.
And now it's position the Storm going into next year, where you have
Breanna Stewart coming back.
Breanna Stewart, an MVP caliber player. Yes.
Another all-WNBA first-team player in the front court with her. Although, if we're being honest, part of the reason Natasha Howard had that opening is because of the fact that Stewart was injured.
Still.
I mean, it's going to be a really tough competition at forward
next
year. And then
with potentially Sue Bird player coaching, bold prediction, already been boldly predicted.
I don't think Dan Hughes is going anywhere.
With Sue Bird player coaching, that's a hell of a big three that the Storm have there for 2020-21, the 2020 season.
Yes.
And it's all contained within 2020.
Yes. You know what year it is.
2020 sounds scary.
It really feels so futuristic.
Yeah. Did you do your list of the top 200 songs the last decade today? Because a lot of publications did.
Today?
Yes.
On October 7th?
I don't know. Well,
maybe, I mean...
This was the content day.
Top 10 songs of the 2010s would be an interesting element for the music year in review.
All right, we'll do it. There we go. It's not the music year in review. We're going to do a music... Right here, you heard it here first. Pelton Cast... Decade in music and review.
I mean, we should do the top 10 of 2019 as well.
We'll do that also. We're reviewing everything.
And we never did a top 5 mid-year like we traditionally do. Before we get to sports, we're back to sports this week. I wanted to talk about a restaurant that I had the chance to go to a couple weeks ago and forgot to talk about last week.
Okay.
So the Seattle Times, as usual, let's say, I mean, I don't think they actually are, obviously. Inspired by what we're doing here on the podcast, had a list of the best chicken sandwiches in Seattle. Then the actual timing was due to the Popeye's chicken sandwich and the phenomenal popularity of that, which you heard about first here on the Pelton Cast.
We invented that.
We were very early on the Popeye's chicken sandwich, which was good because that's how we were able to eat it before it went away for an extended period. Anyways, they did a
Is the Popeye's chicken sandwich back?
I have not heard that it is. I haven't checked specifically.
Ad campaign that's going to happen when that sandwich is back. It's going to be a blitzkrieg.
They better be ready. I'm sure they will be. Anyways, they did a list of Seattle's best chicken sandwiches, and Maono was not the winner, which is shocking because...
Was Maono on the list?
It was on the list. The other nine, I think they listed 10 locations, okay. And the other nine besides the winner were just in alphabetical order or just in random order. They weren't like ranked.
Horrible way to do it. Okay.
But if you're
People need rankings.
If you're the best sandwich in Seattle... In
We're not
honor,
just naming 10 songs from the last decade.
True.
We are ranking those 10 songs.
In honor, I reconfirmed on Sunday night when I hit up the Capitol Hill location and also enjoyed the Dole Whip ice cream float with pineapple ginger beer. That's a great combo. Let me recommend that. A nice late summer combo. Anyways, so they instead went with Soto Chicken. I think we mentioned this briefly on the pod, a restaurant that is in the location of a former Chinese-American restaurant that we used to go to a lot as children. We used to frequent like 10 minutes from my house. I've seen it many times driving by, but I've always been skeptical and have never gone in there. So the Seattle Times review did get me over the hump to go try Soto Chicken.
They call it the best. You kind of had to.
Of course. So let me describe this chicken sandwich.
Anything to prove the Seattle Times wrong.
It's a chicken thigh.
Uh-huh.
Which is generally good. And I mean, I'm not saying it's specifically bad here. Generally good meaning that our favorite chicken sandwich in Seattle, the Maono chicken sandwich, is not a thigh. It's a breast, as we've discussed at length. It's on kind of just a very plain sesame seed bun. Not a whole lot else on there in terms of sauce. I think there's a little bit of mayonnaise. It's been a while. Pickles, of course. And that's pretty much it. It's a no-frills kind of chicken sandwich.
So why did Seattle Times pick this as Seattle's best chicken sandwich?
I would say the number one thing that stood out to me when I was having it is it's very well fried.
Okay.
In terms of, you know, the outside is nice and crispy. The inside, the thigh is nice and juicy. It's got that good amount of consistency that you'd want. Still, I got to say, as the course of eating the sandwich went on, it became kind of repetitive. And it just, you know, like, that's fine with the Mohono chicken sandwich because it's just so delicious.
We need our food to contain multitudes.
Ideally, yes. I mean, my overall verdict on this was it's a solid chicken sandwich. I don't think it's better than... I'm not sure it's better than any of the chicken sandwiches we reviewed in our bracket, which in addition to Mohono included Bok Bok, the Korean style fried chicken, included the Nashville hot chicken at Sisters and Brothers, and then Sunset Fried Chicken.
Was Sisters and Brothers in the list for Seattle Time?
Oh, well, yeah. So all of those were in the list.
Wow.
Yeah. They chose this over all of those locations.
Soto Chicken beat Sisters and Brothers? Because I have to say, I mean, that's a good chicken sandwich. I want to eat it right now. I want to eat the Mohono chicken sandwich right now also. But like, when you're sitting at Sisters and Brothers and it's turning to the fall and you've got some Rainier Tallboy cans eating hot chicken, there's no better experience.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that I felt that Soto Chicken fell under the category of good neighborhood spots. Uh-huh. Now, the tough thing is it's technically in the same neighborhood as Sisters and Brothers.
Well, it's in your neighborhood.
They're less than 5 minutes away from each other, so that's a tough comparison, I think, for it. But not maybe as filling as going with the hot chicken. That can be a lot to digest. Or
as much of an experience.
No, few things are. Okay, with that noted, let's get to sports, starting with our NBA Seattle update, sponsored by Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci wants basketball back in Seattle, and so do we.
Not a lot to say this week. Training camp or preseason is now underway. Markel Fultz, excitingly, is playing for the Orlando Magic, is attempting jump shots. They aren't necessarily going in yet, but encouraging just that he's trying them, I would say.
He's attempted jump shots?
Yeah.
How did he look in general?
I haven't seen any highlights yet. I've just been looking at the box scores. He played on Saturday. The Magic played against San Antonio, where DeJounte Murray played his first game back from the torn ACL.
Look at that.
And then they played again on Monday night before we recorded this podcast at Detroit, I think. Marquese Chris had some nice minutes off the bench for the Warriors in their preseason opener on Saturday against the Lakers.
Is he making that team?
No, they would have to basically trade someone for him to make the team because of their hard cap situation. They only have one player with a non-guaranteed contract, and that's Alphonso McKinney, who's their starting small forward right now. And they literally cannot cut a player and add him. They would have to trade that player to another team with a guaranteed contract to keep him. So, long shot for Marquese Chris. But still, if he plays well, other opportunities may open up for him.
Yeah, maybe showcasing himself for another team. But for Markel, what has the chatter been? I haven't seen this at all.
Generally, that he looks, you know, he looks more comfortable out there. The shot, as we talked about a couple weeks ago on the podcast, when the video came out of him shooting, it's still not what it was when he was at UW, but it's better than it was the last couple of years in Philadelphia.
And he's shooting jump shots.
Yes. He's playing basketball. That's the first step.
All right.
The other guy who's going to play basketball, by all accounts.
Who is that?
On Tuesday night, down in Portland, Michael Porter.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow, what a comeback year for the city of Seattle.
You have to have a lot of players sit out for an extended period of time to have a comeback year like this. But yes, a comeback year indeed.
I mean, it's pretty incredible, right?
I mean, Isaiah kind of falls under the same category, although he's still sidelined with that surgery on his...
Did Markel play at all last year?
Yeah, he played the start of the year in Philly.
Like a few games, though.
I think it was like around a dozen.
So, I mean, we pretty much have... Michael Porter, DeJounte Murray, and Markel Fultz all coming back after a full year of not playing.
Yeah.
I mean, this is going to be an interesting year when we're recapping Seattle basketball.
Absolutely. Porter and will be facing the Blazers, who your Blazers are playing at their traditional home, Veterans Memorial Coliseum, for the first preseason game as part of their 50th anniversary celebration this season.
Where is that?
It's right next door.
Oh.
You've literally walked by it when you've gone to Blazers games. You apparently were unaware that it
was Blazers fan over here.
Where they won the 77 championship, your Blazers.
I was there.
I always find it fascinating.
Dr. Jack, I remember it well.
I don't know if I've ever mentioned this on the pod. I found it fascinating. They played games when they had the Phil Knight Classic in Portland, the PK 80 Classic, 2 years ago, I think now. They played games at both Moda and in the Coliseum. And it was really fascinating being there because it kind of felt like this is sort of what it was like to be at the Seattle Center Coliseum back in the 80s and 90s and going back before that. Because the fact that they've just basically left it untouched from when it was then, and when they're kind of similar in terms of configuration.
What do they use it for now?
The Winterhawks play there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, huge.
Yeah.
Played with them in some NHL 17 or whatever.
Not the T-Birds? Not the Silver Tips?
This was Luca's choice. Is it also worth mentioning the Sonic Boom podcast via Luminary?
Yeah. First episode came out last Thursday, focusing on the 90s Sonics. And the next episode, it'll be one a week over the next 8 weeks. Next episode teased that it's going to be introducing us to Howard Schultz and his ownership of the Sonics. So getting right into it.
This one, the first episode, it was an all nostalgia episode.
It was. And it was very heavy on nostalgia.
Oh my God. I just can't handle it emotionally.
I mean, if you enjoyed that and want more Sonic's nostalgia, I would recommend the podcast that we've done on Sonic's history, the history of Key Arena, which wasn't Sonic specific, but covered a lot of similar territory about the 90s naturally. And then of course, the podcast two-part series I did earlier this year on the 79 championship team. And then lastly, a reminder, mentioned this last week, the Pelton Cast Fantasy Basketball League, started up by third Pelton brother Noah Cohen. I don't think It appeared after I actually reviewed it that the link on the website didn't work last week.
There we go.
So if that still isn't working, if I can't figure out how to get that invite to translate from email to a link for technical reasons, then you can just search Pelton Cast on ESPN Fantasy Basketball to find that league if you want to join and play with the listener. We move right along to the Sounders, who wrapped up the MLS regular season on Sunday with a 1-0 win over Minnesota United FC, clinching second place in the Western Conference. Roman Torres was the hero in his return to the starting lineup after his suspension and scored the lone goal with his head in the 29th minute, his first MLS goal as a member of the Sounders. It was the second.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
He scored the winning goal for them when they won the championship on penalty kicks.
That's not, doesn't count as a goal.
I know, but still, I'm shocked that he's only scored one goal in his career.
So I think he scored in a U.S. Open Cup game.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure I was at a U.S. Open Cup game that he scored, or something that he scored at. No, I guess that was CONCACAF Champions League. One of those two.
Wow.
But he had not scored an MLS goal.
Wow. Well, congrats to Roman Torres.
And a great time for that. It was also the second consecutive clean sheet since he returned to the lineup from suspension. Obviously, he didn't start in the game that they won at San Jose last weekend. Sounders also got Nico Lodero back from injury, saw Victor Rodriguez sit this one out. These Sounders now have secured home field advantage through the first two rounds of the playoffs, which you'll recall in MLS this year have gone to one and done. So home field advantage and, you know, that number two seed, more important than ever in the MLS playoffs because of the fact that you don't have to go on the road at all until potentially
December,
if they got through the conference finals. No, not that
long. You're going to want to work a couple of international breaks in there.
Well, there is going to be one international break here, which is coming up next weekend. Before the playoffs begin, 8 Sounders have been called up to the national teams, 5 of whom will play next Tuesday, just 4 days before the Sounders playoff match. Jordan Morris and Christian Roldan will be playing for the U.S., which is in Canada. Brad Smith for Australia at Chinese Taipei. Gustav Svensson in Sweden. And then Torres is playing for Panama in Mexico. So some players with extended trips to get back to the Sounders before that playoff match against number 7 seed FC Dallas in the opening round. It's not a great draw.
Well, just before then, I mean, can we talk about how strange of a season this was?
Sure.
And maybe this is just the case with MLS in general.
Because the season is so long?
Because it's so long where you're going to feel these kind of extreme highs and lows. But they started out very hot and then went extremely cold. And really, this
had a stretch where they were conceding like 3 goals a match.
It wasn't the type of year where they just picked it up completely at the end of the season.
No.
Still pretty rocky. And then kind of somehow found their way to the second seed here.
Yeah. And ended up like as well as they've placed entering the playoffs in a long period of time. Now, you know, there was a lot more randomness under the old format where you play at home and home aggregate series. So, and the other thing is that just LAFC has been so dominant in the Western Conference that the Sounders' chances of getting into the MLS Cup are not actually that high. But they got a shot. They definitely got a shot.
Okay, so they play FC Dallas coming up, but then I want to talk about the whole bracket.
They had the FC Dallas had the third best goal differential in the West at +8. The Sounders were tied for fourth at +3. Still, home field so big that 538 gives the Sounders a 66% chance to advance in this one. And by the way, some unfortunate timing on this game. It's still tentative when it's going to be played, but it's scheduled for Saturday, October 9th at 19th at 12:30 p.m., which we'll recognize is also the exact time that the Huskies will be kicking off against Oregon, as announced Monday.
Well,
so
maybe we just skip the Husky game.
Jeez. Things have gotten bleak for you in a hurry.
So two matches, one and done at home. Correct?
What do you mean?
Should they win both?
Yes.
Who would they face? Do they go to the conference finals after that?
There's three rounds, basically. It's like the NBA format, except that there's a bye for the top seed.
So if they were to win those first two matches,
that would be the conference final.
They would likely then face LAFC.
Yes. So the second
in the Western Conference Finals.
In the second round, you would face the winner of Real Salt Lake and Minnesota United.
So I mean, looking at this based upon the fact that they're going to have home field in both those matches, should they play two matches?
Yes.
Pretty good shot at playing a home and home with LAFC.
It's almost 50-50 according to the 538 projections. Wait, I'm sorry. Did I say the winner of Real Salt Lake in Minnesota? It's actually the winner of Real Salt Lake in Portland.
Oh, man.
So it could potentially be another visit by the Timbers in round two of the playoffs. I mean, you look at the home records around the Western Conference. Dallas is an interesting example of this. They went 10-1-6 at home. They had only one loss in their 17 matches at home. On the road, 3-11-3.
Wow.
The Sounders were 11-2-4 at home, so two losses out of their 17 matches, and 5-8-4 on the road. So, again, a huge, huge edge to have home field.
They really lucked into this one.
They did. They maybe were overdue for it.
Well, and I think the fun thing about it is that there's not going to be any draws here.
No.
Right? We are talking full-on soccer action, kind of like we saw with the Sounders in Portland to conclude last season, right? Some of the most fun soccer we saw all year.
Right up until that shootout, yeah.
So we're going to see real soccer for each of these two matches if the Sounders advance. I'm excited to see it.
Me too.
Or not see it.
Exactly. Or try to stream it from the stands at Husky Stadium, depending on how things go next weekend.
There's going to be a lot of Oregon fans.
Reign FC coming off an international break where the U.S. women's national team in the ongoing victory tour.
Oh, my God.
Drew 1-1 with Korea on Sunday in Jill Ellis's final match as manager, having won a pair of World Cups in that role. They did beat Korea 2-0 last Thursday. Megan Rapinoe assisted all three U.S. goals during those two matches. She played about 80 minutes on Sunday, and then just the first half on Sunday of that match, as she starts to look ahead to the NWSL regular season finale. The Reign FC will be playing Sunday at Orlando for third place in the NWSL standings. To get there, they need a win plus a Portland draw or loss against Washington. That Thorns Spirit game won't be played until 7:30 Pacific time. Reign kicking off at 4:30 p.m. Pacific time, playing at Orlando. So they will have everything to play for in that match. They won't know what will happen in the other one. 538's Soccer Power Index give the Reign a 22% chance of moving up to third. And it's an important distinction here because there's a big difference between the first place North Carolina Courage, who have a +30 goal differential this season, and the second place Chicago Red Stars, who have a +13 goal differential. So the Courage have kind of dominated the league all season long. Moving on to UW basketball. Men's basketball able to confirm that Jaden McDaniels is in fact has in fact gotten eligible, has completed the coursework necessary, so he will be taking the court for the Huskies this season.
Wow.
They are still awaiting word on a transfer waiver for Quade Green, looking to have him eligible at the start of the season. There's optimism that that will be the case. If not, he would be eligible after the quarter break, as I understand it. So I think that's about the first 8 or 9 games of the season, including a couple against power conference opponents.
When are we going to find out about this?
I don't know if there's a timetable specifically for that. The NCAA kind of, you know, it does
whatever the fuck they want.
Yeah.
But this means that he could potentially be unavailable for games against Gonzaga.
Yes.
And then who else?
Baylor and Tennessee are the two teams they play in on neutral sites. He would be back for the, as I understand it, for the tournament they play in Honolulu, but would miss those three, along with the other non-conference games the Huskies have scheduled. And they are pretty thin at point guard behind him. Elijah Hardy got the start when they played on the international tour in Italy, and the backup minutes went to Marcus Sahonis, who isn't really a point guard by trade. He's more of a spot-up shooter. So you'd like to see Quade Green eligible.
Getting Jaden eligible, though, and this finally being confirmed after a long summer of concern for various reasons, right? I mean, throughout Husky basketball internet, people were concerned about Jaden McDaniels. He didn't travel with them on their trip overseas.
Yep.
And it was probably rightful concern. Then we saw him sort of when they unveiled their jerseys, Jaden being one of the players. They were definitely doing more than just showing off their jerseys there.
Right.
They knew what people would take away from it, and I think that was a bit of a subtle hint that he was going to be eligible. Obviously, no word coming from the team at all during this time period either.
No official comment.
But they're going to have everybody.
It'll be interesting to see. The Pac-12 men's basketball media day is Tuesday, tomorrow as we record
Good
this.
God.
I don't know who they're going to send to represent them there. Usually it's kind of tilted towards veterans, so I don't know if we'll see Jaden McDaniels or Isaiah Stewart there, but you know, obviously those are the two biggest names on the roster as freshmen.
It's going to be an interesting one. This is going to be an interesting season in a Pac-12 that's mostly wide open. The Huskies, I mean, they're going to be picked pretty high up in the Pac-12, if not the favorites.
Yes. There's some Colorado hype. They've got, you know, a lot of experience, kind of like the Huskies last year. But we are now, as we record this, 24 days away from the Huskies' exhibition opener against Western Washington on Halloween.
They'll probably lose. Boo.
Monday was Pac-12 media day for women's basketball. The Huskies were picked 9th in the preseason coaches poll, having finished last year 11th at 2-15 before pulling two surprising upsets in the Pac-12 tournament. They returned 4 of 5 starters from last year's team, losing only guard, you know, kind of sharpshooter Jenna Mosier. So this is, I think, a big year for Jody Wayne, her third year at the helm. She's got some experience now. She's got some continuity. Amber Melgoza, their leading scorer and star player, is going to be a senior. This is an important year for the Huskies to show some progress. So,
still pick 9th, though.
Yeah, no, still not much optimism. And continuing our tour of the Huskies, we turn to the football program. After a frustrating 23-13 loss Saturday at Stanford, where the Huskies did not enter as 16-point favorites, we were correct that that line was too high, but they were still 13-point favorites at game time and end up just kind of getting dominated in pretty much every phase of the game except kicking. Oh, we lost Tristan.
This was tough to watch.
It was.
As with every Husky game at Stanford, it was just so frustrating from the very beginning, right?
I mean, at the beginning, it seemed like, okay, they're going to get this figured out, especially because of the fact that they did go down and they did march down the field and score a touchdown on their opening drive, and that gave them a certain amount of leeway when they came up with a couple of goal line stands. So they had allowed, you know, like 170 yards or 140 yards or whatever it was on the first two drives and still led 7-6, amazingly, thanks to David Shaw's predilection for short field goals.
I mean, I think the game actually turned when David Shaw went for that fourth down and got it.
That was on the second drive, though. That was on the drive they ended with a field
goal. With a field goal?
I'm pretty sure about that.
I thought they took the lead there.
Which it's amazing that they weren't more aggressive given the fact that they ran the ball so well throughout this game. Yeah, that was on that fourth and two at the 50, and they scored. They ended up kicking a field goal on that one. That was when they got to 7-6.
Just nothing went well.
No.
And I don't even want to say I told you so, because I don't think that I could have possibly predicted how badly this game went. I don't think anybody could have.
Yeah. I mean, this was going up against the Stanford defense that came in bottom five in terms of opponent completion percentage, bottom five in terms of opponent yards per attempt. And against that, Jacob Eason, and not that it was entirely or even primarily his fault, goes 16 of 36 for 206 yards, 5.7 yards per attempt. That is shocking. And especially after starting 5 for 5 on that opening drive, as I mentioned, after that, he completed 11 of 31 passes the remainder of the game. It's inexplicable. You had, I mean, just so many factors in it. The protection broke down, the number of drops, Hunter Bryant's inability to catch a contested pass.
Oh,
Aaron
God,
Fuller had one costly drop, even though it's tough to blame Aaron Fuller too much when he was the only receiver who is even remotely productive. He had 171 receiving yards in this game. The rest of UW's receivers combined for 35 as a group.
Where are you getting 35? Well, just from everybody else.
Yeah.
You're including tight ends, because wide receivers.
No.
I'm seeing one catch for 9 yards from Terrell Bynum and one catch for 1 yard for Andre Bocelli.
Yes, that was receivers in the global sense rather than receivers the position.
I just don't really get it. I just don't get what happened here. I mean, we knew that the defense was a bit suspect, and I think ultimately this is a game that was probably lost by the defense, but they gave up 23 points, and going into this game, you said if Stanford scores 23 points, the Huskies are going
to
win.
I don't agree with that. I mean, I think if we're like evaluating relative to Stanford, the performance of the two units, the offense was way worse than the defense in my book.
Scarlett ran for 151 yards.
Yeah, but he ran for 4.6 yards per carry. It felt worse than it was. I mean, there's an element of...
Was this person's name Davis Miles?
Davis Mills is the quarterback.
Oh, Davis Mills.
That's the quarterback.
With an 84 QBR. I mean, pretty much untouched.
Yeah. Yeah, the pass rush is not great.
Their run defense isn't great. The pass rush isn't great. And the secondary isn't great. What is good on this Husky defense?
On the Husky defense?
Yeah. Miles Bryant?
I mean, I think the receiving aspect of it, first off, I think Davis Mills is a good quarterback. I am confident in that. I legitimately believe that. Watch him now. I don't know who Stanford's playing this week, but watch him like go 15 of 30 for 150 yards. But it was also a real matchup issue. Stanford, even though they don't have a lot of athleticism necessarily at receiver, they do traditionally have a ton of size, and they were able to just repeatedly get their tight end, Colby Parkinson, matched up. I guess he only had two catches.
Two catches for 42 yards.
But they went for 42. They were able to get him matched up against Elijah Molden in the slot, and Davis Mills was just putting pinpoint perfect passes over Molden's shoulder. The coverage, there was nothing wrong with it. It's just you're covering a, you know, much bigger player. Parkinson's listed at 6'7", which puts him very much in the Kobe Fleener tradition.
The Austin. What we're talking about here is that they spread it around to tons of different receivers. They shredded this UW secondary. Which the only thing that's shocking is that USC wasn't able to do it the previous week.
So I think, I mean, like, the fact that the pass defense was so bad is tough to totally understand, but I think part of what's at play is the Husky defense is extremely good against air raid style offenses. You see it every year against Wazoo in the Apple Cup. Knock on wood. We'll see about this year. Wazoo also does not seem to be as good. But you saw it, obviously USC employs air raid principles, you know, and you saw it against them. But the teams that are more physical and rely on size, like Stanford, I think can have more success against this UW secondary, which is not exceptionally big.
But also, the USC receivers are massive.
Yeah. But they weren't necessarily, I mean, they were double covered, and, you know, UW wasn't playing that defense. It wouldn't have made sense in this time. Then they would have gotten run over even more than they did. And then there's just the element of tackling. Anytime someone does catch a pass or run, it's
you have to actually tackle them?
Yeah. It is a requirement. You can't just pull their flags like in Baby Fantasy Geniuses game. I do think the run defense wasn't as bad as it looked. I mean, Scarlett ran for 4.6 yards per carry. Richard Newton ran for 6.4. Savon Ahmed ran for 4.7. They maybe didn't get enough carries, but and there is an element of, and I think this is in Chuck Klosterman's new book of short stories, like if you had a play that gained precisely 2.5 yards every time, you could never be stopped. Mm-hmm. And there was an element of the consistency at the end of this game that made it impossible for the Huskies to get off the field, even though it wasn't necessarily a lot of yards per carry. But you can win a game, give you 4.6 yards per carry to their leading rusher.
Do we have third down stats?
Yeah, that's in the team stats.
Let me see this.
They were 6 of 14. The Huskies were 2 of 12.
I mean, a lot of those were granted. Okay, Stanford outgained the Huskies by almost 200 yards. They beat them in every facet of the game.
But part of the way you beat someone by 200 yards is because you're extending drives, you're running a lot more plays. They had, what is it here?
9.5 yards per pass.
They had 74 plays to the Huskies, 58. They had 16 more plays.
And they had the ball for 40 minutes compared to 20 minutes.
Yep.
I mean, they just dominated the Huskies in every fashion in this game. Do we think that the Huskies didn't run the ball enough?
They probably should have run it more, yes. I rarely would say that about running, but in this case, they were having so little success through the air, and they were having success on the ground, particularly before Richard Newton got injured, and, you know, hopefully...
What is Richard Newton's status?
Coach Pete didn't really have an update at practice on Monday, but said that it... I mean, said he was still seeing specialists, but that it wasn't as bad as it looked as on the field, where it looked really awful. I mean,
why does Savon Ahmed only run the ball 6 times in this game?
That's a great question.
After having a career day against USC.
I mean, I think if I'm to explain the thinking from Coach Pete and Bush Hamden, it's that, well, look, Stanford was this horrible pass defense. Of course we came into this game planning to pass all the time. But you just didn't see an adjustment. And, you know, that third down, 2 of 12 on third downs in particular, they repeatedly went empty on those situations, ran a bunch of slants, and they just either... Eason couldn't put the ball on the money, or the receivers couldn't make a play, particularly Hunter Bryant, who got 1 of 5 targets to him, which is shocking. I mean, that is someone who I was convinced was the best offensive player on the team.
Until you saw Kate Otten. No, I mean, this Aaron Fuller game, he had a monster game again.
Targeted 17 times in this one.
Is Jacob Eason good?
I don't want to overreact. He's been victimized by a lot of drops.
This is 20 incompletions, though. I didn't have that many drops in this game.
No. I mean, the tough thing to understand is, and the scheme was not good. The cult, like all this, the scheme was not good in this game. That was a lot of what happened. But he's down to 9th in QBR, and Jake Browning last year had the same set of receivers, basically. I mean, I don't think that... that Ty Jones has been that big of an absence this year. And he had the same offensive coordinator. And last year, he was, let me pull this up, 4th in the conference in QBR. And everyone thought he was terrible and needed to be benched in favor of Jake Haener.
What's the difference?
In other words, Jake Browning did nothing wrong.
Is it just that Jake Browning did nothing wrong? Do you think that they're scheming differently? Would they have gone into this game... I mean, they weren't down by that much for most of the game.
No.
It's not like, you know, it's not like a golf game where you need to throw the ball 60 times because you're down.
But I think they came into the game with a plan and they just never adjusted. They just kept running out that game plan. And, you know, sometimes you can be guilty of over-adjusting based on a small sample size. But in this case, what they thought based on film was going to work just didn't, and it kept not working.
I remember a game against, I think it was Utah like 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, where they were just really struggling throughout the game, and then they came out at some point in the third quarter, and they just ran every single play, and then scored a touchdown. It was like, this is, they're like, you know what? This shit isn't working. We're just going to run the ball until they can stop us. And I think the Huskies needed at least one drive like that.
I mean, they did have a drive that was mostly like that, but then they'd get into the red zone and start passing, which did not take.
They literally needed one drive, and it felt like it was going to come, and it was going to come, and then it just didn't.
No.
I don't believe that Jake Browning would have thrown the ball 36 times in this game. And I think that they're approaching Jacob Eason in a way that's making him less effective.
It's possible.
But, like, when you're watching in the moment, without even, like, we're not enamored with how tall Jacob Eason is, right? We're not scouts over here. We're not, like, so excited that he's overthrowing players. The passes that he makes look like the right passes in the moment.
I mean, I do wonder with the drops whether there is an element of the velocity of the football being making it more difficult for his receivers. Because, again, these same receivers didn't have a problem with drops last season. They had other problems, but they didn't have a problem with drops.
Well, if this were one game, I think we could write it off as an isolated incident. But now that both of the Bay Area schools, San Francisco's overrated.
Change my mind.
Both of the Bay Area schools have done this to UW. It feels like a problem.
Yeah. Especially when you've got multiple entrants in the competition for what's the worst loss of Chris Peterson's tenure as head coach in the same season. A question I tackled statistically on the blog. That's a problem. And it doesn't necessarily get easier for the Huskies on Saturday as they head to Arizona to take on a Wildcats team that is on a four-game winning streak, has won four in a row since losing their opener 45-38 at Hawaii. Their defense allowed 79 points in the opening two games to Hawaii in northern Arizona, but since then has just allowed 61 in the last three games, all versus Power 5 competition. All of those, of course, wins as part of that winning streak as they moved up to number 46 in ESPN's Football Power Index. The guy making it all go is Khalil Tate, who leads the Pac-12 in QBR. He's completing a career-best 67.5% of his passes for 9.1 yards per attempt after slipping to 56% completions while battling a serious ankle injury in his first year under Kevin Sumlin. Last week in their win over at Colorado, Tate went 31 of 41 for 404 yards and three touchdowns.
So scary.
He is very scary. Tate, with the better health, even though he actually missed a game due to the win over UCLA with hamstring and ankle injuries, already has more rushing yards than he did all of 2018. He's only got, it's not nearly where he was as a sophomore when he had 1,411 rushing yards.
Is there talk about him coming out after this year?
He's a senior, so yes. Oh.
I feel like there's a chance that he's... So yeah, he had...
He also had 12 rushing touchdowns as a sophomore.
He had 1,400 rushing yards and then had a down season last year.
Where he went to 224 rushing yards.
I feel like Khalil Tate is like the next Pac-12 quarterback to be criminally underrated.
He's going
to
be the next Gardner Minshew?
I think so.
I would love him as the Seahawks backup quarterback. With all due respect to Geno Smith. So in that win over UCLA, freshman Grant Gunnell came in and beat the Bruins, averaging 9.1 yards per attempt himself. Tate has the one downside is you can turn him over. He's thrown five interceptions so far this season in the four games he's played. Remarkably, is a senior. This is the first game he's played against UW because they missed each other the last 2 years, and he didn't move into the starting line or into the lineup at all until after they played UW.
That's crazy because I remember playing him before.
Nope. I don't know who he is, but it wasn't Khalil Tate.
In the desert?
Nope.
Wow. Was it Manny Wilkins that I'm thinking of?
Possibly.
Nowhere near as terrifying as Khalil Tate.
No. I mean, Khalil Tate led the entire country in QBR as a sophomore.
If he were the quarterback of Oklahoma, he would win the Heisman and be the number one pick in the draft.
Oh, you see, I'm sorry. He was not number one. He was number two that year to Baker Mayfield. I mean, the team also was not very good that season. And he
is
didn't
Khalil Tate's fault, though?
He didn't play a full season.
He doesn't play defense.
No.
Same with Gardner Minshew last year. Well, I guess Wazoo was pretty good last year, but...
They were. Yeah. And he benefits from the fact that QBR weights rushing EPA more heavily than passing EPA, which is something that Ben B noted last week on Twitter. But still, he's an incredible quarterback.
Was that as part of him insulting Russell Wilson?
When was he insulting Russell Wilson?
I don't know. I'm just curious why he was noting that.
He was explaining how QBR works.
Okay.
Also, Russell Wilson doesn't rush for yards anymore. You know, it's Dad Russ now. It's all free plays.
Oh, God, I love the free plays.
Love a free play. So Arizona's starting running back.
Dad Russ now?
No, it's full on Dad Russ, man. Starting running back, J.J. Taylor also missed the UCLA game with a leg injury and then played just the opening series at Colorado. They won that game despite not getting much from backup running back Gary Brightwell, who has combined for 18 carries and 60 yards over the last 2 weeks. So that's good news if your run defense is terrible.
Yes.
If J.J. Taylor does not play in this game. Tackling Khalil Tate, an entirely different matter
this
altogether.
This is what we've come down to hoping.
Opponents have averaged 47.4 pass attempts per game against Arizona, the most of any FBS team. In that context, the 337 yards per game they've allowed, which are third most, actually not that bad. 7.1 yards per attempt for Arizona opponents, basically average, and their 60% opponent completion percent rate is actually the third lowest in the Pac-12, just ahead of UW. So, but still, their defense is not very good. They rank 60th in FBI efficiency as compared to 15th on offense. And then they are really, really bad on special teams, 120th in FBI efficiency there. Pretty uniformly bad, but notably, their kicker, Lucas Havrasek, is 3 of 5 on field goals this season and has missed an extra point. So he's no Peyton Henry.
No, oh, bright spot.
Yeah.
That's his nickname. Richard Newton is a bright spot, too.
Yes. It's like a Keith Gilbertson season where you've got to look to special teams and a backup running back as the high points of the season.
Who's the punter? Sean something?
Sean Douglas?
That might have been it. Sean Douglas when he was the best player on the team.
How are you feeling about this one?
I just don't know.
A late night in the desert, 8 p.m. kickoff.
I want to see none of it.
Well, good news. You're not going to see any of it.
I want to be eating delicious burritos in San Francisco and not watching this game.
Okay.
It is going to be... Okay. The optimist in me, the part of me that says... Whatever happened at Stanford was just an outlier. It was a strange situation. Sometimes you get unlucky on third downs. Sometimes you get unlucky with turnovers, whatever, right? Every once in a while, things just don't go your way. And realistically, if a couple of balls go slightly different, the whole game is changed against Stanford.
Sure.
So that part of me says Eason is going to bounce back. There's no way Bush Hamden is going to be as bad as he was last week against Stanford, and this offense is going to dominate Arizona's defense. They're going to give up points to Khalil Tate no matter what.
Yes.
Even the Husky defense at their absolute best would have given up points to Khalil Tate.
Yep.
So whether Vita Vea or Ben Burke-Hervin, Byron Murphy, Buda Baker, those players are out there, it doesn't matter. They're giving up points to Khalil Tate, and that's what's going to happen again in the desert. This is going to be full-on Pac-12 after dark shootout style.
Yep.
And can the Huskies score more?
Not the kind of game that they have typically won a lot of historically. Not typically the kind of game they played a lot of historically. So it'll be interesting. Chances of victory?
45%.
My heart says like 40%. My head says like 75%. So I'm going to...
75%?
Or I guess 70.
Against Arizona?
Against 70.
Khalil Tate? You think there is a three-fourths chance of winning? No way.
So I'm going to split the difference and go like 55%.
There
chance.
We go.
Yeah.
That is more like it. Even being above 50, you're being a cockeyed optimist.
Huskies 6.5-point favorites in this game, I believe.
None of this shit matters.
I mean, it does, actually. It's very predictive.
We knew for a fact that spread was insane for the Huskies. Even when it came down to 12, it was just like...
13.
The 6.5 points is what it should have been against Stanford.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with
We've
that.
We've played games against Stanford before, and spoiler alert, it's always bad. When you go into Stanford, it's bad. That's it.
Just can't deal with that home crowd.
And I think that's... I have no idea why this happens. And for whatever reason, they seem to play Stanford quite well at home.
Yep.
Right? I kind of always have.
No, not always. I don't know if you remember the Jim Harbaugh era, good sir.
They beat some good Stanford teams at home.
I don't know if you remember them yelling about the highest paid staff in the Pac-12 and we just kicked their ass.
Jim Harbaugh said that?
Yeah.
Wow, good dude. Love him. It's all right. Things are just about to turn around at Michigan.
They got a very impressive 10-3 victory last Saturday.
Oh, their offense is so close to putting it all together.
I would kill for a 10-3 victory for Stanford.
That Super Bowl that he participated in was really nice also. Close game. It's just... if there's one thing that you never feel confident in, it's the Huskies going to the desert.
No, it's not been a great place for them.
I mean, they can win there, but it's the type of place, especially in Pac-12 After Dark, that has kind of haunted them. And having this, we looked at the schedule and we said, okay, we have all the right teams at home, and maybe we were wrong. Maybe we'd rather go at Oregon.
I mean, I did say going
into
the season,
Oregon.
But I thought that at Stanford was going to be the toughest game of the year. So
maybe we'd rather go at Utah, right? We've been to Utah and beat them a lot of times, right? Utah has never beaten the Huskies since they joined the Pac-12, correct? In Utah, at the very least.
Yeah, I don't think so in Utah. I think their win came in Seattle.
Oh, that was that Troy Williams game.
Yes.
Right, in the wind.
No, Arizona State beat Troy Williams, but Utah did win here at some point in that area. The Huskies did win their last visit to Arizona 35-28 in 2016, a game that went to overtime. You'll recall that was a Pac-12 After Dark in its own right.
No recollection of that game whatsoever.
You were
That was the
someone was sick. We didn't watch the game together. I drove back from Vancouver that day.
And I remember we won it because of like a tipped pass or something. And I remember just collapsing to the ground and being like, thank God we did that.
Could be a reasonable preview of this game. J.J. Taylor was actually their starting running back at that point. The quarterback who you were thinking of, who was a dual threat, was Brandon Dawkins.
Not Khalil Tate.
Who had 176 yards and 2 touchdowns on the ground in this game. That was a fun one.
He had one really long touchdown run.
That checks out.
Yeah, that was one where maybe not unsimilar to the Seahawks against the Rams on last Thursday night.
Yeah, he had a 79-yard touchdown run. LaVon Coleman had a 55-yard touchdown run, and the Huskies won it on a Dante Pettis touchdown in overtime.
You just collapse to the ground, take a deep breath, and say, thank God we made it through.
I really enjoy these old Husky box scores. That should be a regular fixture of this segment. Well, let's move on to the Seahawks. Again, had the emergency pod to recap their 30-29 win on Thursday over the Rams. I think one topic we probably need to discuss before we start previewing this week's game is that Russell Wilson, with Patrick Mahomes' rough performance, injury-hindered performance in the Chiefs' Sunday night loss to the Colts, Russell Wilson has emerged as the favorite for MVP.
Is he the gambling favorite?
I haven't looked that up. But
I mean, we talked about this all on the post-game pod, basically. If Patrick Mahomes doesn't exist, we're watching Russell Wilson's MVP year.
And it turns out that the healthy Patrick Mahomes might not exist.
It's early.
It is very early.
This is one game. You can't judge things when one player is coming off a win and one player is coming off a loss. Because realistically, if that field goal from Greg Zuerlein tucks right into the goalpost instead of right out of the goalpost, it's a completely different conversation.
That is accurate.
So I don't want to get too out of control with this idea because it's too outcome-based, right?
Yeah, I guess the gambling line has not caught up here. Mahomes still a -120 favorite and Wilson at 5-1 right now on Caesar Sportsbook.
Is there anybody else ahead of Russell Wilson?
No, he is number two.
Still, that's awesome. It feels like Russell Wilson's getting the credit he deserves. People are taking notice of the season that's happening.
until Pete Carroll is taking notice and Brian Schottenheimer. The only thing that can hold him back.
Those 23 passes he threw were the perfect amount of passes.
Pete Carroll also had no update to offer on Monday at practice on DJ Fluker's status coming off that hamstring injury that sidelined him on Thursday. Jamarco Jones came in and replaced him, something I don't think we discussed in the postgame pod, and was effective in his first NFL action on offense, playing out of position at guard, a game position he had never played in a game. Had a 95% pass block win rate, according to ESPN stats and info, while occasionally going up against Aaron Donald. So that makes you feel better about Jones's chances of holding up if he is forced to start this week.
I mean, the sample size is extremely small.
Yes.
But I would probably venture to guess that offensive linemen playing their first ever game, you're not, with even with small sample size, running backs, wide receivers, even sometimes quarterbacks, offensive linemen, though, eventually it feels like it catches up with you, right? If you're so completely overmatched, it feels like eventually something is going to catch up with you. And it didn't really happen at Jamarco Jones in this one.
And he'll have some extended period to practice here at guard, so you'd think he'd be even better prepared for this Cleveland game, although maybe they'll be prepared to deal with him.
Oh, the Browns.
Well, they do have this guy named Sheldon Richardson on the defensive line.
To deal with Jamarco Jones.
They were not prepared to deal on Monday night with the San Francisco 49ers, who dealt them a 31-3 defeat that is complete in every phase of the game, as the Huskies lost to Stanford was earlier in the weekend on the not far from Santa Clara.
During this game, people were asking the obvious question, which was, are the Browns this bad? Or are the 49ers this good? And I think DVOA sort of answered that question.
It weighed in, for sure.
And right now, sitting at the sixth best performance of all time through five games? Four games,
because they have the bye.
Right now, and I'm not saying this will continue, the 49ers are this good.
I mean, they have to be considered the heavy favorites to win the NFC West, which is not great news for the Seahawks. It really means that, you know, especially with the South looking strong, Carolina coming on lately, the East still a chance of them putting two teams in the playoffs. There's a pretty good chance that, you know, if the 49ers keep up anything remotely close to this, that the Rams and Seahawks are playing for one playoff spot. And in that context, that Greg Zuerlein field goal miss looms enormous.
I just want to caution taking too much about the Browns from this game.
That's fair.
Because I think the 49ers are a little bit overrated by DVOA. Right, they did play a close game with Mason Rudolph's Steelers.
They are probably not that good.
But the Browns are not this bad.
They entered the game 14th in DVOA with their 2-2 record. That's obviously going to go way down. They were outgained in this one 6.3 yards per play to 3.9. It was a dismal day for Baker Mayfield, who completed 8 of 22 passes for 100 yards and 2 interceptions. Tough break on actually probably both of his interceptions. He was hit on the first one, and the second one was a pass at the goal line that got deflected up and intercepted. And, you know, that effectively ended the Browns' hopes. They were driving at that point down 14-3, had a chance to make it 14-10. Instead, San Francisco comes down and scores the other way and makes it 21-3 going into halftime. And that was pretty much all she wrote.
And tough breaker not on those interceptions. Baker Mayfield finished with a QBR of 1.4. I don't want to describe him as benched by the end of the game, because I don't think that's really what happened. I think they were more preserving Baker Mayfield.
Yes.
But it couldn't have felt good to be on the sideline at the end of this game for him.
No. Mayfield, experiencing significant regression after his strong close to his rookie season, has 8 interceptions so far, about 1 every 20 pass attempts. And sacks have been a big issue, even though the offensive line has generally rated pretty well. metrically. He was sacked four times on Monday, twice by Nick Bosa, and now has 16 total through five games after just 25 sacks in 14 games as a rookie. On a rate basis, that's up from 4.9% of his dropbacks to 9.0%. By comparison, Russell Wilson is at 7.7%. So I think the number one question about this game is, how much pressure can the Seahawks get on Baker Mayfield?
Would be a huge game to get Jaron Reed back for. And sadly, they have to wait one more week. But you have to feel like with both of these pass rushers, Jadeveon Clowney having another week in the Seahawks system, Ziggy Ansah getting that much healthier, you have to think there's a good shot at them being able to get after Baker Mayfield.
Well, I hope so, because they haven't done much this season. Their 4.9% sack rate on defense ranks 26th in the NFL. So they need more of that.
There's definitely situations where, you know, I think in that Rams game in particular, they adjusted some things to make sure that they were focusing on the run. And as you know, Pete Carroll would probably give up quarterback pressure to shut down the run.
He would give up anything to shut down the run. Not explosive plays. I guess he wouldn't give up that.
Never explosives.
Which, by the way, everyone's talking about Pete Carroll fetishizing that Colts victory over the Chiefs because they ran the ball so effectively and kept the Chiefs offense off the field. But the Colts were dominated in terms of explosive plays, and he would not have liked that. It was like a historic differential for a winning team in terms of explosives.
Really?
Yeah, they had one and the Chiefs had 10, I think, was the number that I still
think Pete had a nice night watching that game.
He's got like a bottle of wine, just enjoying that game.
But I think the one thing that we definitely need to focus on is, in particular, watching this 49ers game and how well they ran the ball against the Browns defense.
Yeah, I mean, it's surprising against a pretty good front four that, as I mentioned, added Sheldon Richardson to a group already led by Myles Garrett. They gave up 275 rushing yards Monday on 40 carries, 6.9 yards per attempt. Not quite as bad when you take out the 83-yard Matt Breida touchdown on the first play from scrimmage, but still about 5 yards per carry outside
of that. And also,
that
happened.
It did happen.
I think the one thing that got them, which I'll be curious to see how Shoddy Ball approaches this game, and really the motion, the pre-snap motion of the 49ers seemed to really fluster the Browns and led to there being pretty huge holes for these running backs and a lot of carries. But when you look at the yards per carry for some of these backs, you have 10.4, 6.1, 4.9, 18 on the one carry for George Kittle, 15 for Marquise Goodwin, right? Pretty much everybody dominated in this game. And are the Browns going to worry about this going forward? Of course they are. But should we see a Tyler Lockett carry in this game? Absolutely we should.
I mean, I think that we're going to see a lot of Chris Carson carries, maybe some Rashad Penny carries. I mean, it's interesting because this hasn't necessarily been a huge problem for them beforehand. I mean, you look at the game against the Rams that they lost at home on Sunday Night Football in a 20-13 game, which wasn't their defense's fault. In that game, Todd Gurley, 14 carries for 43 yards. So they shut him down. Robert Woods did have two carries for 18 yards. Brandon Cooks, 1 for 8. So maybe that edge stuff, you know, getting the receivers involved in the running game can be effective. But it's tough to know, again, what to make of, you know, was that for real or the 49ers just that good?
Well, I suppose it's kind of interesting seeing those two games, the NFC West games, in comparison, because they're running sort of relatively similar, you know, trying to spread the field pre-snap motion type of stuff between the 49ers and the Rams.
So getting back to the Browns offense, Odell Beckham is becoming a story, I would say. Had nearly as many yards passing, 20 on one attempt, and rushing, 15 on two carries, as receiving with 17 on two catches on Monday. He was targeted 6 times. And now has 335 receiving yards through 5 games, which is the third worst 5-game stretch of his NFL career in terms of total yardage. And the previous two were 334. So,
well, and a lot of that comes from one play, too.
Yeah, he had the 89-yard touchdown reception on Monday Night Football against the Jets. Showed he's still got the big play ability there, but he came into this game with negative DR, and it's probably only going to go down from there.
And he was also playing the Jets in that game.
That is true. In Greg Williams. Did not think that he was, what was the term again? I don't know, whatever it was. Didn't think he was that. What are the Giants thing? Jarvis Landry leads the team with 403 yards thus far and fewer targets than Odell Beckham. Haven't really had a third consistent receiving throughout with tight end David Njoku injured. Antonio Callaway returned from a four-game substance abuse suspension on Monday and did not catch a pass and was the target, the receiver who tipped up that pass that was intercepted at the goal line. So not a great start for Antonio Callaway coming back. Nick Chubb was a bright spot on Monday, going 16 carries for 87 yards, 37 of them on one big run.
Even then, it's like, I mean, this was a fine performance.
He was the Richard Newton of this game.
But I'm not going to say, it wasn't a monster performance there.
No, but how are you going to have a monster performance in a game you're trailing by two touchdowns basically the entire time?
I mean, they ran him a lot in the first half. And I would say his success rate had to be quite low.
That's possible. Going back to Cleveland's defense, the big concern is Myles Garrett, the former number one pick, who has seven sacks this season, second most in the NFL, and nearly as many as the Seahawks have as a team with nine so far. You're going to have to account for Myles Garrett and make sure that he is not in Russell Wilson's face. And then the special teams have been strong for the Browns. They entered Monday Night Football positive in every Football Outsider special teams category, save kick returns. And particularly strong has been their kicking game. They drafted Austin Siebert in the fifth round out of Oklahoma, and he is 8 of 8 on field goals this year. And I definitely will not note here that some of us wanted the Seahawks to draft a kicker instead of signing expensive veteran kickers. Although I went and looked, and their two picks before him were Ugo Amadi and Ben Burkervin, so I'm not sure I would have wanted them to use either of those two picks on Siebert.
Would have been giving up some pretty important special teams play.
I mean, you got to have BBK.
So, I mean, the real question here is that we just don't know what the Browns are. It's been 5 weeks. They're 2-3. But to answer the question, are the Browns good? We probably can answer that question, but what to make of the Browns is a more difficult question beyond there. Like, each of these losses, you can sort of explain away a little bit, and I think Baker Mayfield ultimately ends up as one of the biggest question marks for the team in general, and it's not just Odell Beckham doesn't exist in a vacuum. He needs somebody to get him the ball, and Baker Mayfield has not been able to do that. He's felt pressure a lot, and noticed in this game that the concern about him, particularly in that Rams game, was that he would get flushed out of the pocket very quickly, always leaving to his right when he's leaving the pocket. And then so he's sort of shortening the field, right? And he can't thread those throws in the same way in a short field that somebody like Russell Wilson can yet. However, he bounced back by dropping 40 on the Baltimore Ravens the week after that.
I mean, that's what makes this team so hard to figure. They've got to be the highest variance team in the NFL from week to week at this point.
I mean, are they, though? Like, when you look at this...
Yeah, they lost by 30 to Tennessee.
But they have one good performance. That's what I'm saying, is maybe we can answer the question of are the Browns good a little bit. Because when you look at it, they lose by 30 to Tennessee at home. They beat the New York Jets. Granted, this was with Sam Darnold, but even then, the Jets are probably one of the five.
No, that wasn't with Darnold.
He was out in that game too?
No, that was the game that the backup started and Luke Falk came in relief.
That was the Browns game?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
I am quite certain that that's the game Trevor Siemian started.
Okay. Well, then you have they beat the Trevor Siemian plus Luke Falk.
But they didn't just beat them. They destroyed them. That was 23-3.
The Jets are potentially the second worst team in the league.
Sure. I mean, I don't think their performance against the Rams was bad by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, the other 2 weeks, they've had two awful performances. One, I would say, really good performance, and two fine performances.
Baltimore also is a bit of a question mark. Like, what is Baltimore's reputation based upon? Where do they rank in DVOA this week?
I mean, we don't have the update after their game against Pittsburgh. But
I mean, they did play a close game against Kansas City. But, like, they also went to overtime against...
the Pittsburgh team?
Pittsburgh! And I was trying to think of who the quarterback was. Davis Hodges?
No, Devlin.
Devlin Hodges. Devlin Hodges was 7 of 9 for 68 yards and a 97 QBR against the Baltimore Ravens.
I did not realize that he was that good.
So the whole thing just boils down to...
I mean, they've got two losses by at least four touchdowns this season, and they have a win by two touchdowns. They have two wins by at least two touchdowns. That's pretty high variance.
All right. Well, and so they have not won at home yet all year. They're 0-2 at home with one huge defeat against the Titans in week one, and then a bit of a tougher loss against the Rams. This feels like a winnable game for the Seahawks.
Of course it's a winnable game.
This feels like the type of game where the Seahawks can also run the kind of offense that they want to run. If they could have the exact same offense that they had against the Rams, where they lean heavily on the run, mix in the pass, if Russell Wilson passes the ball 23 times in this game, the Seahawks are going to win.
I don't know if I'm going to guarantee that. I can see some scenarios where Russell Wilson passes 23 times and it's not great.
It's for the Seahawks, it's almost the reverse of their stupid rule about rushing attempts or whatever.
Yeah.
You actually want fewer passes because that means that the offense is going well. And it means that the defense is playing.
Sometimes it means they're going run, pass. So I think that's a distinct possibility in this one.
They're not. The Seahawks don't go run, pass that often.
Ben B, get on that. Answer that question for us.
As opposed to last year, like they've been passing on first down and play actioning on first down more than I think we would have anticipated.
I don't feel like there's been a more play action than last year.
The offense has evolved just the slightest bit.
I feel like the evolution has been the quick strike passing, but I don't know that there's necessarily been more passing. Yeah, I mean, I think this is the kind of game that we talked at the start of this about the situation in the NFC West, where you've got a team that is 4-0, you've got a team that is 3-2, and we know is very good despite the fact that they've lost their last two. It's every game matters at this point for the Seahawks, and this is the kind of 50-50 type game that can determine at the end of the season whether you make the playoffs or not.
I mean, you just look at the schedule going forward, and there's almost no guaranteed victories on the schedule.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the Seahawks don't play the AFC East, which would be a lot of guaranteed victories.
Looking at the fucking Patriots schedule,
it's worst.
It's sickening that the Patriots play that schedule. It makes me wonder if there's schedule collusion happening. Even if there's a formula to the schedule, something is happening to this. This is almost, playing at Cleveland is almost a must-win game for the Seahawks, though.
I mean, I'm not going to go that far, but it is an important game. So what do we think their chances of victory are?
I think they're 60%.
That's interesting. They are two-point underdogs as of last week in this game.
I thought that was... I'm curious if that's going to change after tonight.
It had already gone up from... They were two-and-a-half-point dogs before Monday Night Football. I do suspect that there's... I think this ends up close to a pick 'em. I'm going to say an even 50% in this one.
I think the Seahawks will end up being favored in this game.
Okay. Well, it's going to be an interesting one for us to watch from San Francisco. I guess I'll be watching it from San Francisco. You'll be on a flight.
I got to change my flight out of Oakland at like 6 a.m.
Good luck with all that.
I'm flying out of the town. But so looking at the schedule going forward, right? At Cleveland, I mean, we just talked about it might be a pick'em game. Baltimore is a really hard team to sort of handicap at this point. And they're going to see a unique offense in Lamar Jackson. Also, having the return of Earl Thomas to Seattle, it's going to be an emotional game. The easiest game that remains on the schedule, other than Arizona at home, is looking like at Atlanta right now. And Atlanta's still a dangerous team.
I would still say with home field that Tampa Bay at home is probably easier than at Atlanta, but...
Tell me Tampa Bay isn't terrifying.
Oh, especially Bruce Arians, because that's Central League field. I'm just saying, like, if you were looking at it from a strictly statistical perspective.
But it's just like the hits start coming and they don't stop coming with the schedule.
Really did not expect a Smash Mouth reference on today's pod.
The only team on the schedule aside from Arizona.
Oh, wait, is that Smash Mouth?
That is Smash Mouth.
Okay.
That you couldn't see going to the playoffs is Atlanta, right? Because Cleveland, yeah, you could easily see going to the playoffs. Baltimore, you could. Tampa Bay, you could. San Francisco appears to be a virtual lock at this point.
They're not a virtual lock, but they're...
Philadelphia, Minnesota, the Rams, the Panthers, and then the 49ers.
Yeah.
Like, it is just...
The NFC's really good.
It's a murderer's row that
some
they're
good
facing.
Teams are not going to make it in the NFC.
And every NFC team is facing this. I mean, I look at every single week and you see games that are happening, like 49ers, Rams. I think there's a bit of a chance of a Rams spiral happening this year.
I guess it, you can't rule it out.
There's also a chance of the Rams being 3-3 and then not losing after that.
There's a chance of many things.
You don't think that's a
No, I think it is a possibility. I'm just saying that there's a chance of a lot of things. That any chance rule, I invented that.
Seattle Times is going to write about the any chance rule pretty soon. Ranking the top any chance rules in Seattle.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.